If we can get everyone back into the room first and then around the table if appropriate and in your seats and settled and ready to roll.
Should I do this
one? Yes. I'm not sure how much activity there is out in the hallway, but we'll sort things out when they hear voices in here through the amplification. Barbara, I guess you are going
to kick this off.
Thank you.
So this afternoon we're going to be talking about shared genes and emerging issues in privacy. And as our first speaker, would like to invite Susanna Baruch to talk about existing structures for privacy and non-discrimination protections beyond GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me to talk today. I've worked with many of you for many years as part of the Hopkins Genetics and Public Policy Center, and starting tomorrow, I put on a new hat to work for a group called Generations Ahead, whose mission is to bring together progressive communities, including racial justice, disability rights, and reproductive rights, lesbian and gay advocacy groups, to have a more active voice in genetics policy discussions. Today, I have not started that job. I think I'm officially hatless, which is sort of liberating when you get to talk about an issue about which you might have some personal opinions. So any mistakes or controversial statements that I make, I claim as my own. They should not be attributed to any other organization. And I think I want to start by saying that this talk probably represents a pretty significant shift from the main themes of this morning, which were primarily about the validity and utility of the genetic testing being done in direct-to-consumer contexts. I'm going to talk about privacy and non-discrimination. For many years, my work has focused on the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act and issues related to that. It would be odd in the context of talking about GINA, as it is known, not to mention that, like virtually every other important piece of civil rights law or health policy law that has passed in this country in recent decades, GINA couldn't have happened without the spectacular vision and hard work of Senator Ted Kennedy and his brilliant and spectacular staff. I grew up in Massachusetts, and having lived in D.C. for 15 years, I still feel like Senator Kennedy was my senator and always probably in some sense will be my senator. So my first goal today is to just talk for a minute about the purpose and scope of GINA, because I think it's relevant in thinking about what other privacy and non-discrimination protections do or could, but maybe don't yet exist for genetic information, whether it's done through direct-to-consumer genetic testing or through more traditional channels. And I'm also going to talk about some state law issues that are kind of in play. And I want to talk about that legal framework in terms of how direct-to-consumer genetic testing might be specifically implicated. Doesn't like my picture. So GINA is a piece of a larger puzzle of privacy and non-discrimination issues. And many have argued that there's no need to think about genetics differently from other health information and genetic information differently. But for better or for worse, there's sort of been a consensus among policymakers that there is something special here about genetics. And I want to, just in a very short nutshell, talk about the three big arguments for thinking about genetics differently. At an almost gut level, I think that the issue of genetics and privacy boils down to a sense some people have that there's something intensely personal about their DNA, that it's sort of their extra private secret code, invisible to the outside world, critical to their identity. Sometimes when I think you look at this argument very carefully, it sort of boils down to something my six-year-old might say, which is sort of a, no, mine, no, 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 mine, mine, mine. It's not to be shared unless I say so, and it's something that I should control. So that might be one reason to think about genetics differently. A second argument raises really maybe the most basic, it really doesn't like my pictures, all right. Well, raises a very basic question of fairness. My genes are not my fault. it would be unfair to treat me or my family members especially badly in one way or another based on our risk for disease or for some other negative trait. And in particular, this argument goes when the predictive value of a genetic test is imperfect or imprecise or even unknown, I shouldn't lose the things I most need, like my financial support, my health insurance, or my job, when today I can do that job, or today I don't have any bad health outcomes. So today my health is good, today I can do the job, my genetic information is predictive, it would be unfair to mistreat me on the basis of what you think you know about my future. And perhaps on the most sort of concrete, practical level, the third argument in favor of thinking about genetics as a special thing is the fear that individuals have had of losing their privacy and being mistreated, that fear has interfered with the willingness of individuals to undergo genetic testing. So there are many stories of people afraid to take tests that their doctors recommend or unwilling to participate in genetic research that could benefit all of us. So the argument here best expressed is the impact of the fear of genetic discrimination is that we all lose if we don't assuage it. We all lose the benefits of that health, of health care and of potentially health research. So I think most of you are probably familiar with the basic tenets of GINA. GINA prohibits group and individual health insurers from using a person's genetic information or requesting or requiring that a person undergo a genetic test. And in employment, GINA prohibits employers from using a person's genetic information in job-related decisions and or from requesting, requiring, or purchasing genetic information about the individual or a family member. Now, before GINA, there were other federal laws that were in play that provided some protection from genetic discrimination, and those laws continue to exist, and sort of from a lawyer's point of view, they continue to be kind of in the tool chest of laws that may provide some protection. HIPAA both protects the privacy of all personal health information, a broader group of information than genetic information, which is held by the entities that are covered under the law, and HIPAA provided the first protection from genetic discrimination in health insurance in the group health market. We also have the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and other civil rights and employment laws. Even before GINA, the ADA was interpreted by the EEOC, the federal agency charged with enforcing it, to protect people from genetic information on the job, but it was an interpretation of the ADA that was never really tested in court. And part of the motivation behind GINA was to clarify that these protections do exist. So there are other issues at play in the use of genetic information in discriminatory ways. Typically, individuals seeking genetic testing are wanting to know about their health risks, but I think it's important to think about genetic information as also revealing the possibility of serious financial risk and vulnerability in the future. Because a genetic test can give information that could allow people to prepare for the possibility of a devastating illness. Or it could predict the likelihood of that coming. And illness often results in the inability of a family member to work, loss of income from the illness or death of a wage earner. GINA does not prohibit an insurer's use of genetic information in setting rates for the insurance products that are aimed to protect people from that outcome, life insurance, long-term care insurance, or disability insurance. Now, should insurers be allowed to deny people the protections that these forms of insurance give based on their genetic risk? I think this is not a simple question. I don't want to stand here and say they should that we should have those protections or we shouldn't. These are complicated insurance products, perhaps considered less critical to people's well-being than other areas of insurance. On the other hand, these forms of insurance are of utmost importance in preventing real financial devastation. Some states have begun trying to address this issue, whether the use of genetic information in these contexts should be permitted. And as you can see, currently there are 16 states that regulate the use of genetic information in life and disability insurance and 10 states in long-term care insurance. The approaches to this issue vary widely. Some of these laws looked at carefully, don't provide all that much protection, but attempt to sort of maybe just set a placeholder for addressing it in the future. But clearly the activity at the state level in these areas has increased greatly in the recent past. Sandra did a very nice job of raising briefly some of the issues related to social networking and GINA that are sort of floating around. To back up for a second, GINA will become fully effective in November of this year. And in the meantime, the federal agencies that are charged with enforcing it are currently trying to finalize regulations implementing it. And what that means is that every nitty-gritty question anybody ever had about GINA and what it really means and what it really prohibits and what it doesn't, these agencies are trying to resolve through the federal regulatory process. And there's a few of these questions that are really quite relevant to direct-to-consumer genetic testing, and I just want to spend a minute talking about three of them. So the first issue here is the question of the care, the medical care, that genetic testing tells people they might benefit from. And this is obviously relevant to direct-to-consumer genetic testing and to all genetic tests. So if my genetic test reveals that I need or should or would benefit from preventive care or early detection or early treatment or some kind of specialized health care or health management, who's going to pay for that care? Does GINA promise that that care, the crux of the benefit that genetic testing provides, is going to be covered? It's not clear in GINA that it does. And it's much more likely, I think, that those are issues that are going to be resolves through more traditional decisions about what health insurance can and can't cover. But as an example, BRCA genetic testing, a positive genetic test could result in a recommendation from a person's personal physician for increased counseling, increased surveillance, surgery, tamoxifen. GINA doesn't require that insurance pay for that early intervention or those preventive measures. So it's fair to say that the crux of GINA, the question of follow-up care, is going to be one, I would think, utmost in the mind of a DTC client or consumer deciding whether or not to opt in to some of these tests that may indicate a need for further medical care. And at the very least, when a consumer is deciding to go forward with the genetic test, knowing the extent to which they are protected in getting the care that they might need is something that they should know and something that should be included in counseling and consent. So there are also some issues, as Sandra talked about a little bit, swirling around the use of genetic information by employers. Many of you know, many of you may actually participate in wellness programs that are offered by usually larger employers where employers under other employment law can offer health care on the job and ask employees to participate and insist that they do so in the sense that they can offer them financial incentives to participate or financial penalties if they don't. So the debate that relates to GINA focuses on wellness programs that might ask for family history about cancer or heart disease. And these are issues where the question of that family history, which is essentially genetic information, and whether it's appropriate, given GINA's purpose, to allow an employer or an entity associated closely with the employer access to that information, that's an open question under the GINA regs. It's particularly relevant to our discussion today because it's my understanding that at least some of the larger direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies are starting to offer genetic testing as part of some of the larger employer wellness programs. So your employer might offer you access to direct-to-consumer genetic testing and then work with you in order to improve your health based on the results. So GINA is very much supposed to prevent and prohibit the collection and use of this history. Should we allow employers to use direct-to-consumer genetic testing as a way of collecting not just family history, but the genetic test results itself? The third issue I would mention that continues to swirl in the GINA regulatory world is that there's an unresolved issue about the extent to which it may be considered inadvertent or accidental for an employer to learn something about an employee through the use of online sources. And these online sources can include social networking, a Facebook page, a message posted in an online support group for a particular disease, or the social networking sections that exist in some of the direct-to-consumer genetic testing sites. So in my view, these are electronic resources that should be off-limits to employers. My boss shouldn't be able to do an end run around Gina by deciding to join the same message group that they suspect I may be part of and hope to learn something about my prognosis or my outcome, predictive genetic information. But these are unresolved issues, and I want to just provide you with my take on where these federal agencies should go. So direct-to-consumer testing, I mean, ironically, offers people perhaps the privacy that we crave or that Gina also appeals to. And so let me talk specifically about this for a minute, and I also want to recommend an article some of my colleagues, a statement from ASHG that some of my colleagues helped craft that first sort of laid out some of the questions about privacy as promised by direct-to-consumer genetic testing. What this testing offers, theoretically, is the ability to receive test results outside of your regular system, off the grid, out of sight, out of pocket, and to keep it under your control and to keep it only in your knowledge. And so for people who care about privacy, DTC may seem particularly appealing as an option. But I think the question is, in the long run, does DTC really mean that your privacy is enhanced? And how can you know? So one of the issues is that the privacy offered through direct-to-consumer testing doesn't necessarily have the protection of HIPAA. So HIPAA's privacy protections don't apply to most DTC companies. These are not covered entities under HIPAA. And consumers sort of need to know this. They need to know what it means. So even if the DTC using crowd is kind of a Google-friendly crowd, they give up their data, they think there's going to be benefit from it, the context here is different, and the question of consent, I think, becomes even more important, that you need to understand that by offering what you may perceive as a medical service, this is not a medical entity in the same sense where your health information will be protected. And we heard this morning in David Becker's talk that I'm not picking on him because he's not in this chair. I'm going to just pick on him because I saw it this morning. The policy that he offered was that privacy needs to mean an appropriate use of genetic information, and that would be sort of boiled down and made clear to consumers. I think appropriate is in the eye of the beholder, and knowing what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate, who decides if they're appropriate, is what's a really complex issue here and one where we all need some guidance. So should a direct-to-consumer genetic testing company be able to keep the sample that you submit and retest it for their own purposes, for research, for quality purposes? If they do research, is it IRB approved? If the company goes out of business, what happens to your data? These are the kinds of issues that come to my mind when I think about what is an appropriate use. And we may differ on what's appropriate, but clarity about what it is and what it isn't are important. And perhaps at an even sort of more concrete level, I think quite rightly, most direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies advise people, once they get their genetic test results, to talk to their doctor about what it means if there's some real health decisions to be made or healthcare decisions to be made. As soon as I tell my doctor about a genetic test result, as soon as I show up with the printout, that information becomes part of my medical record. And to the extent that my medical record is available or protected by HIPAA, but on the other hand, perhaps available in other contexts, it's no longer under my control. And so what I think is that even if the company has a really good privacy policy, by using the genetic testing, if that information ends up in that medical record, it could, for example, be requested. If I'm not protected under my state law, it could be requested by a life insurer or a disability insurer who asks me to consent to have my medical record examined. So the shift into outside of the control that DTC offers consumers, I think, can happen quite quickly. And for me, I mean, to put it perhaps overly simplistically, the bottom line is, if the information you get direct to consumer actually matters for your health, it's not going to stay private. It will end up with your doctor, and it may end up with one of the insurers that you choose to do business with, perhaps as a result of finding out that information. So I want to just sort of end with a few additional questions, some of which have been raised this morning, and I think many of which will be discussed today and tomorrow. Figuring out who owns genetic information is not sort of a simple inquiry, but understanding what a particular company's rules for use and sale and disclosure and research needs to be as clear as possible. I think the other issue when dealing with a private entity is understanding under what circumstances the rules can change. You may consent to one thing, but if the company is taken over, if the rules change, who gets to change them, under what circumstances, what notice does the consumer have later of where those rules go? And I also think that as we are starting to see some state laws or state rulings relating to direct-to-consumer genetic testing, understanding how those state laws intersect with state laws on some of these insurance questions is also going to be very important. As a final note, I would say some of the discussion this morning, what struck me was a need to understand better what some of the users of direct-to-consumer genetic testing think, what their experience is when they go through this, and as time goes on, what their experiences are of vulnerability or perceived vulnerability in terms of how that genetic information may or may not feel any more or less private than if it were delivered in a more clinical setting. Thank you.
David, then Jonathan.
Yeah, Suzanne, you made a comment about having somebody's information. I have two points. One is, if somebody's going to put genetic information in one way or another on the web, why do you think that an employer doesn't have a right to access it? I mean, once you do that, it's like crying out to the world, look at me, I've got XYZ. So it seems to me that if an individual makes a conscious decision to publicize this kind of information, I don't understand why you say that an employer or anybody else doesn't have a right to see it.
I'm going to answer your question sort of from two directions. Certainly, I think there's sort of an evolving societal discussion about, if you're about to hire someone, can you Google them? And how much should you find out about them? What's the sort of social contract for doing so? And certainly, I think, you know, younger people who might have pictures on their MySpace page that they would be embarrassed about later are starting to sort of think about the implications of revealing more. The question of whether an employer can look for information about an employee in a place that is most likely to reveal information that is not relevant to their ability to do the job is, I think, a very difficult employment law question. So if my postings are about my future health risks, should an employer who is not allowed to ask me questions about that be allowed to look specifically on the internet for information about that? If we're going to outlaw it in the interview context, is it appropriate to say anything goes on the internet?
Well, I would just say to that, I think people have to have some responsibility for how they behave. And you know, you just, I don't find the argument at all compelling that I can't see something that some person, whether wisely or stupidly, puts out on the internet. I mean, it's not a private depository.
And just to argue the point, I mean, if the interviewee offers the information, the employer not asking it, they waive the right. So if you go in and say, oh, I'm 6 months pregnant, and nobody asks you, are you pregnant,
know the information, so it's the same sort of thing.
You know, I think
it's how you use it then, and one can have a different argument about it. But the
well, I think it depends on your view of how people do and should use the internet in their private lives. If we assume that as time goes on, fewer and fewer people will decide not to use the internet for the things that they want simply because it might come back to bite them, then we're taking away a huge portion of what the internet has done. The internet has created communities that did not exist previously, and it's connected people that would not otherwise be able to be connected.
Public.
And it is public. But.
But.
You are, as an employer, not allowed to go look for information in certain public databases. You're not allowed to look online for articles about somebody. There's sort of a sense in Gina that there are areas of sort of high risk areas of inquiry that you are not allowed to say to somebody, "How's your sister? What was wrong with her anyway?" In the same way, you're not allowed to look for that information on the internet. I think these are difficult questions, and to be fair, the federal agencies that are trying to figure this out are certainly
so what's
struggling
your
with them.
How would you
craft it? You can look anywhere you want. Could I, as an employer, join 23andMe to go on their social networking section in order to look?
I know parents who track their kids' Facebook because it's the only way they can figure out what their kids are up to. So is that fair? I mean, that's just the way it is.
Well, we've always had different rules for employers than for parents.
Right. The other point is that your mention of the lack of HIPAA extension to the DTC companies, I think, goes back to a point I was raising earlier. The line between DTC and all other segments of society that are either collecting, analyzing, or studying genetic information, I think, is exceedingly blurry right now. And I have a huge conflict of interest here, and I'll just put it right out. I'm an academic, and I don't see why, if we have to live under all these restrictive, protective rules, other people doing essentially the same stuff shouldn't. I mean, that's not fair, right?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I was listening, so I appreciate your talk. It was great. I just didn't want to walk in on the middle of it. Thank you so much for bringing up these issues. I think privacy is a huge issue that, as you point out, we don't understand all the ramifications yet. We're all trying to work through these things. That's why we've hired a privacy officer and try to really focus on HIPAA and establishing all the HIPAA rules here now, as well as bringing in the ISO 27002 level standards. We want to meet those standards to the best of our ability. Kind of talking about what happens to the data after, if a company fails or or gets bought out. We think that this is a legal contract, binding contract, that we have with our clients, and that should be passed on to anybody that buys our company, or if we happen to fail, we're obliged to destroy that data at that time. So we feel like we're trying to meet those standards, and we're not just going to pass around anything to anybody's insurance company when they come knocking on the door. So we stand up to them and basically maintain our contract with our employee.
Can I ask a question? I'm curious to know the extent to which you would be... I think some of these policies are going to show themselves as what they should be over time, sort of based on the experience both of the company and the users. And do you have a mechanism in place or a plan for sort of reevaluating privacy as time goes on?
Michael Cox is our plan. He basically stands toe-to-toe with us every day and keeps us. We have a plan to keep him in place and to keep evaluating this process as it goes along. Absolutely, we want to adapt and maintain those high standards.
Back to your slide on the insurance situation in, I think it was 16 states who are looking to, I don't know, plug holes and do some more on GINA, post-GINA. I've heard insurance industry people say that if the way we're going, life and AD&D insurance may no longer be a profitable marketplace, and they will have to go out of business because each of us, and even maybe by Googling, other parties will have access to information about us that they don't have, and therefore they are in an adverse selection position. What do you think about that?
I think this is a very difficult policy issue. I don't, and I think it's one worthy of some close examination. Certainly, insurers say that about health insurance whenever there's an effort to reform health insurance. One person's profitability is another person's unfairness. I think there are real questions about how important we think it is to impose our views of what the access to these insurance products should be for an average American. I think that the fact that our genetic knowledge is shifting over time, maybe it's becoming more precise, maybe it's becoming muddier, complicates the issue. So if we thought that a life insurer could make a perfect prediction of our life expectancy, or as close to perfect as is possible, if we knew everything we could possibly know about the human genome, would we feel differently about it? Or in that case, would we say, well, then what's the point of having life insurance at all? So I think they're very complicated issues, and I don't have a sense of where I would want it to come out.
Well, this question has been with us a while. I remember vividly David Korn and I and a number of others 13 years ago identifying the problem of the disproportionality of knowledge in the insurance context because of genetic insights. And if the insurers are forced to act behind a curtain of ignorance while all others possess perfect knowledge in a business where actuarial tables determine what the company's survivability will be, then I think we can predict the result. I would be crazy as a 45-year-old man armed with certain information, having three children, having terrific information based on genetic work, not to game, the insurance for my family in their interest. And that problem is going to increase. It existed then. It exists now. It exists in the future. Cynthia Kenyon, an interesting researcher, as some of you know, was in the same circle of people then. I think she was brilliant. She'd done great work. She must have been 25 years old at the time. She said, well, national health insurance, universal health insurance, would cure this problem, essentially, because the risk pool would be the population. That's probably not the exact program that's being discussed now for health care reform, but the idea of greater risk spreading, that may be the area to investigate it in order to see how to handle this issue and still ensure genetic privacy.
Life insurance often, though, is individually underwritten, right? So on that model, you wouldn't have a big pool
for
life insurance, much of it anyway.
That was exactly my question, brought about by having heard the someone speak who was doing the Reveal project, looking at giving APOE4 information to the general public and talking to a group of insurance executives about his results, basically explaining to them the extent to which someone could get real information, which is all, usually I worry about information being incorrect and protecting people from insurance companies, so it's unusual for me to feel about protecting insurance companies from information that's too correct, but I mean, that is one thing for long-term care disability insurance. If you can find out in advance that you have an enormously high risk of Alzheimer's, it's an actually available, real piece of information, and it's hard for me to know how the companies are going to be able to offer the insurance under those circumstances. But also why I was standing here would say there's a very big difference in terms of, yes, if my child put something up on their Facebook and when they were a senior in college and didn't have the sense to take the thing down that was going to get them in trouble, it's sort of like, well, it's your own problem. You did something dopey. But there are other uses of the internet, and I'm not sure that we don't want to think about companies, you know, developing programs where they know who are in chat groups for people who are BRCA1 or 2 positive, for instance. Do we not want to be able to have those types of sites, you know, for people available if people are going to be able to get off their information, you know, not I'm making an announcement about what my gene status is, but something that you can then use as implied information. And I think the implied information ultimately is going to be a bigger danger. People will get that you can't go online and announce things you don't want to be known to the world. They've been remarkably slow about it, but yet I have faith that people will get that you can't do that. But it's, you know, when the information is actually out there, though not necessarily legally available, of like every search you make and every, you know, every statement you make in a chat group or something, there's a lot of implied information that could be dredged for, and I think that ultimately will be the bigger concern in terms of that privacy.
I certainly agree with your first point. I agree with both of your points. The APOE question, I mean, the REVEAL study found, in addition, that people do, in fact, increase their uptake of long-term care policies, which makes perfect sense, right? This is a disease where the impact can be devastating. Long-term care is exactly what people need, and the predictive value is good enough that it makes sense to make that investment. And then what do you do with that fact? The fact, unequal information, on the other hand, people really need the care. A difficult question. You were hoping I'd have an answer. So no, I do also appreciate your comments about the internet. I think some of this is that we are all, I mean, in the last 5 years, I've gone from being a naysayer to having a Facebook presence. I don't know if that's good or bad. I certainly think about, what my kids will do with their internet presence. I expect over the next 10 years for my views to shift dramatically again. And if what we say is, anybody can have access to anything you ever do online, and you just have to, you know, buyer beware. There's a lot of worthy uses of the internet that are going to have that would need to go away, and I think that'd be a shame.
So thank you so much for a wonderful discussion. We're going to turn to Scott Woodward now on genetic identity and community. Scott.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I think I may be a slightly different animal than what we've seen so far today, in that we're very much involved in genetic testing, in databases, and but not so much in medical testing, and not so much in direct-to-consumer test selling, but very much in database building and very much in affecting an individual's sense of identity and sense of community. The Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation was started just over 10 years ago in Utah. As a part of a university. At the time, I was a professor at Brigham Young University, working on questions of population genetics. This man, a private individual, said, I have some real questions about who I am. Who am I? And how am I connected to the rest of the people in the world? And can you tell me something about it? And it was a very interesting discussion that we had over the next 2 or 3 months in trying to figure out if there was, in fact, a way that we could answer some of those questions. And the big challenge that he came up to me with, and that fit fairly well into my research program at the time at the university, was, is there a way that we can essentially break down walls of identity, break down walls of community, and demonstrate to the world that we are, in fact, all connected in very real ways, that we share something at a very elemental level, something that is widely shared among lots of individuals throughout the world. And so we attempted to take a stab at this. And that's what has now evolved into the Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation, with the idea of creating a comprehensive database of both genetic and genealogical. Now, that's another item that we're bringing into this process, this family history idea. And it directly addresses some of the questions directly brings up some of the questions we've had about some of these secondary participants, especially when you add genealogical information to genetic data. It's a lot easier to get at some of those secondary participants and bring that information together in two separate databases, but they can be queried and used together. And then build the tools needed to help individuals reconstruct their identity or reconstruct their social group or reconstruct their community using that DNA, or reconstruct their genealogies essentially using that DNA, and then make that data available to the public. And his idea, Jim Sorensen's idea, was to do, I'm going to fund this. I'm not going to ask anybody to pay any money to find out this information. I'm going to fund this to build the database and to build the tools and to make this available. And so to this point, we've not asked anybody to purchase a test. But we have asked a lot of people to donate their DNA and their genealogical information. Today, we've collected from throughout the world about 170 different countries are represented, 108,000 DNA samples under informed consent. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. And also, associated with those DNA samples, we've collected extended pedigree information. We now have, through our process of evaluating these genealogies and essentially scrubbing this pedigree information, about a little over 90,000 pedigrees associated with those 108,000 DNAs. These pedigrees are very interesting in that they have an average depth of 11 generations, which is quite a bit of work to be able to pull that type of information from an individual who has donated DNA. In our pedigree data set, we have 7.8 million ancestral names. There's a little bit of discrepancy here in the number of actual names that we have, because there's overlap in that the same individual appears on more than one individual's pedigree. We currently have that scrubbed down to about 2.6 million unique names, but we're not all the way through that. That will continue to grow as we finish up some of these pedigrees. We've also now collected genetic data on a number of these DNA samples. We have about 77,000 mitochondrial D-loop sequences associated with those DNAs. And we have 315. We've just recently started getting whole mitochondrial genome data. We have 315 of those genomes that are in our data set. And then we've also looked at Y chromosome haplotype. There's some reasons for mitochondrial and Y chromosome that personally I didn't like when we started this, but we were essentially almost, and this is an interesting point in light of what we're talking about and dealing with here, but we were essentially pressured into this by the community, by the individuals out there saying, we would like to know something about our mitochondrial and our Y chromosome DNA, because there are other companies out there that are providing that information, and we think that this is where we need to go to find information about our genealogy. Our goal from the beginning, and it is still at this point, is to actually work with the autosomes and to work with the nuclear DNA in reconstructing genealogical information. We'll come back to that in just a minute. But we also have about 40,000 Y chromosome haplotypes These are STR haplotypes, complete at 37 loci. And another interesting little component that the genetic genealogy world really hasn't used much, but it's DNA on the X chromosome, which has its own individual inheritance pattern and can tell us something something about our ancestry that either the mitochondria or the Y chromosome can't. We have about 74,000 haplotypes or sets of haplotypes on X chromosomes belonging to those 108 individuals so far. And then the autosomal genotypes we're dealing with, again, about 78,000. These are STR type genotypes, not our our SNP chips. We'll talk a little bit about those also.
What is STR?
Short tandem repeats. They're last generation, two generations ago, genetic information. We also have begun our large chip analysis of some of these individuals, starting with some populations, and now have 300 completed using the Affymetrix 6.0 chip. I'll talk a little bit about what that's done. Some of the places in the world that we've collected. I just want to use this as an example of how we do these collections throughout the world. This collection was done 2 years ago, last month, in Mongolia. It took us about 3 years to set up the collection, in that we needed to line up collaborators, both with universities. National University of Mongolia was our main source of collaborators, but also the governmental agencies, to make sure that the consent and the IRB that we were working under here in the United States would be transferable, what changes we had to make sure that we were in compliance with the types of rules and regulations that were in place in Mongolia. And then working with local anthropologists, outlined the country and asked, where do we need to go to get a good sampling of the individuals in Mongolia? And there are about 28 different known ethnic groups in Mongolia, and we wanted to make sure that we tried to get as many of those as possible. So you can see from this, it's not very easy to read, but you can see all of the different places, locales that we collected from in trying to get an overall picture of what was going on in Mongolia. And one of the things that we found, and actually it's really not very surprising, but when we started to look at the genetic diversity within Mongolia, this is the most genetic diverse place in the world right now, but that's probably not true. But what it is, it's an artifact of the sampling, in that we've been able to sample this country extremely well, we think, and in doing so, we've discovered a tremendous amount of diversity that we probably didn't really expect going into that country to start with. As I mentioned, we've collected all of our samples under informed consent. Originally, working under the direction of the IRB at Brigham Young University, 4 years ago we moved the data sets, the collection, the whole foundation, the whole molecular genealogy database outside of BYU and into its own entity. At that time, we did not continue to use the IRB at Brigham Young University, but transferred that to a private IRB, the Western IRB out of Olympia, Washington. And we've continued to maintain that to this point. Our informed consent includes a description of the study, some of the things that we will do. When we started out our original informed consent, and this is an interesting problem, and I hear it coming back and forth, and I see it all of the time, especially with the direct-to-consumer genetic testing, in that, you know, if you have an 8-page consent form, 12-point type, going out to these individuals, can you even think that they can? First, will they read it? Can they read it? Can they understand it? There's a real challenge here in being able to explain exactly what it is that you are doing, what you want, and what's going to happen with that data. We've worked very hard over the last 10 years in trying to get that to the most understandable and cover the subject and still do what a informed consent needs to do, and we're down to 6 pages. And that's still where we are with our informed consent. Talking about the risks, a couple of them have already been addressed here. Linking genetic results directly to you, loss of confidentiality, that you may, in fact, you are at risk of losing some of your what you think to be confidential information if you participate in this study. What benefits there are, whether there are payments, there are no payments in our study, that this is voluntary, that you are participating, and that you may withdraw at any time. We've had 108,000 samples we've collected. To date, we've had 17 individuals request to have their information and DNA and data withdrawn from our database. It would be really nice to know why, but we put that in that you can withdraw for any reason and we won't even, no questions asked. And so we've had 17. What our responsibility of confidentiality is, how we will use the data. And because this was set up originally in a university under an IRB, and in my laboratory, the idea was that this was a genetic study, and it was ongoing, and it was moderately open as to what we would be able to use that data for as we move down the road. And then where is our money coming from? How is this being funded? there are a number of issues that we need to deal with, and I don't know that we have the answer at SMGF, and I think that's part of what we hope to look at in this workshop, is what is the balance between privacy and my right or my want for self-awareness of understanding who am I, what most can I know about myself? How can you help me find more about myself? Who owns the genetic data? And in our case, who owns the genealogical data or any other personal data, for that matter, that a person donates to the database? And then again, what about secondary participants? Especially in our case, I think we have this difficult situation where we have both genetic information that I may share 50% with a SIB, but I also have genealogical information that may or may not name him as a SIB also. And even though these are kept in separate databases, and I'll show you how that's retrieved in just a minute, there's some more maybe danger associated with that type of information when it's there, as far as especially secondary participants. What about discrimination, genetic discrimination, and the effectiveness of GINA? We just had a little bit of that discussion. Is that going to protect an individual's rights, or whatever those are? What are those rights that we're dealing with? And what happens with these social networks based on direct-to-consumer genetic testing results? There are social networks, and this is something, in some ways, the genie is out of the bottle. I mean, we've got this situation out there already. And in 2 years, we're going to have a $1,000 genome. And in 5 years, we're going to have tens and hundreds of thousands of individuals who have purchased their $1,000 genome. Who's going to have that? Are we going to have 100,000 individual people out there that have it? Are we going to have companies that have that information? Are we going to have academic institutions that have that information? I mean, this workshop is probably overdue by about 5 years, maybe. I don't know how far that is, but it's something that really needs to be addressed. And I don't know that we can really go back and put the genie back in the bottle. The reality is that it will be there, and it will be available, and people will use it. And so how best can we help manage that? I'm not sure. But there are things that you can build social networks, and the direct-to-consumer testing companies have built social networks based on mitochondrial or Y chromosome haplogroups, sets of individuals who share the same deep ancestry based on either their mitochondrial DNA or their Y chromosome DNA. And also, there are tests out there that claim to identify ethnicity. I'm going to discuss that more in just a moment. I have reservations about the use of that word, especially when we talk about origins. As Sandra spoke, the definition, what do you mean by origin? We'll come back to that. So if you look at a pedigree chart of an individual, and you go up across that blue line across the top, that's their paternal inheritance. That's what is I share, if I'm sitting over here on the left, I share my Y chromosome DNA with that individual, that one, and that one. So by knowing my Y chromosome DNA and assuming that this pedigree, in fact, is correct, then I know something about my father. I know something about my grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, and all of their male sibs. I know something about their genetic information. Likewise, if I look down along this other side, my mitochondrial DNA, I also know some. It, right now, at the level of interpretation of this data, it's still quite gross. We're not down very well to the individual level on being able to identify that, but it will happen. It's getting very close. Likewise, I can follow my mitochondrial DNA down here, but the real guts of everything is in the middle here. And up until this point, direct-to-consumer genetic testing for genealogical purposes or for family tree searching type DNA has not utilized this. But that's it's only weeks or months away until they will be using that type of data to try and reconstruct information about the rest of this pedigree. So who am I? What am I? This idea of origins that Sandra brought up. If I take myself as an example, I am a member of the Utah Gene Pool in 2009 in USA, okay, 100%. If I go back a few years, I wasn't a part of the Utah Gene Pool at that time. I was a part of the Virginia Gene Pool, USA 100%. Okay? So what am I? Am I Utahn or am I Virginian? Well, it depends, doesn't it, on when we want to define that origin. If I go back another 30 years or so, who am I? Well, I wasn't all around in 1933, but my parents were, right? And all of the genes that make me up, is that right? That I am made of? I better be careful. We're present in my parents. So what do I know about my parents? Well, using the genealogical information that we have in the database, I can identify that my parents were actually in Utah. And so now I'm Utahn again. All right? And so what am I? Well, if I go back again to 1900, what am I? Well, if I look at my grandparents, three of my grandparents were in Utah at that time, but one of them was in Lee, Lancashire, England. So what am I? Anybody guess where I'm going here? You know, if I get back here to 1800, what am I? Well, my Y chromosome line says I'm American. I'm still in the USA at that point. Okay. My mitochondrial line says, no, I'm Swiss. Okay. But, you know, I know my genealogy tells me that, well, I've also got English, I've got Danish, and I have Swedish that's in there. So what am I? And, you know, I tried really hard to find a picture of a mutt, but that's what I am. But the reality is that, you know, I'm not too far removed from any of you in here, in that that's the same situation that we deal with. So it goes back again to this origins question of who am I, what am I, that Sandra brought up earlier. So at SMGF, as I mentioned, we've spent the last 10 years building this data set, and this is how it's now available. The bottom part of that mission was to make the data available to the public. So how can we do that in we hope, a responsible way, but also a useful way, so that people can actually use this data for the purposes that were stated in being able to identify and their genealogy. That's really what we were after. And so this is an example of our Y chromosome search. This is actually using a surname. I can go into this database. It's publicly available. You can go onto it in the web, and you can plug your surname in here. And right now, what it does as a default, it just sort of takes our mean value in our data set for all the alleles of the Y chromosome that we test at. And I'm going to ask how many Woodwards are in our database. And when it comes back, it turns out that there are 17 Woodwards. That surname shows up on 17 different lines in our database. Now, it'd be really interesting if all 17 of those Woodward lines were exactly the same on the Y chromosome, because we see these surnames follow that Y chromosome lineage in a lot of Western cultures, but it doesn't. There's actually 14 different Y chromosome types that are associated with this Woodward surname. So it really doesn't identify me in that database. I'm one of those. I'm one of those lines. It doesn't identify me directly. But what we've done is that wouldn't be a very useful tool for anyone trying to find a relative or someone to connect to in our database if they had the same surname as Woodward. But there's another little part right here. You see a couple of icons. This is a pedigree. If you push on that pedigree icon, this is what comes up. This is the data that's associated with this this number 3 sample right here. Goes across here. If I push on that icon, this is what I get. It connects into the genealogical database that we have, and it shows a number of individuals, and it shows a lot of names, including this guy up here, Franklin James Woodward, up here. But it also has a number of individuals that are shown up as protected. Those are individuals that were born since 1906, I think, at this point. Anything for the last 100 years, any kind of personalized name information or genealogical information associated with an individual that was born within the last 100 years is not shown, and it's not accessible. It's actually not even on the public accessible data set that's there. But once they get to be 100 years old, then we do reveal that. So that's the type of information that's available on that data set. Now, just really quickly, there were 3 ideas of identity that I wanted to address. I'm not going to go into these stories, but ones that we post on our website of people who wanted to know who they were, had no idea. This individual, he's been trying to do his genealogy. He gets back a couple of generations and he finds the end of his trail. He suspects that there's been a name change for whatever reason. Can I find something out about it? He looked at his Y chromosome DNA, he compared that particular DNA with others in our database, found some other surnames that were not his, and started doing some research on those individuals and, in fact, found a connection. Another one, this one was particularly rewarding to me. I don't know, this was a population study. This was in South Africa. We have a data set of a large number of individuals in South Africa. We have the situation here of a number of children off the street who are living in a shelter provided by the city of Johannesburg. The idea was to try and reconnect them to their biological family. This particular kid had been in the shelter for 14 years. We didn't have an exact match for him in the database. We tested him. We didn't have an exact match. But what we did have is some indication of some populations nearby that may fit. And so the social workers went to work and started asking questions and interviewing, and actually found this boy's family, found his father and a brother, and were able to reunite them after 14 years. And again, this woman of African-American descent, wanting to know, where does my ancestry come from, was able to find some very nice close possibilities in the database, was able to follow up on that and find out more about who she was and where she was from, and addresses now this sense of identity, sense of community. She now has a community that she feels a part of, wants to be a part of, although there are some limitations as to how tight those definitions really can be at this point. And let me just finish with just an observation on what it means, again, for origin and what it means for community. In that this is data that we'll be presenting at ASHG next month in collaboration with Lynn Jordy's group at the University of Utah, where we have about 800, almost 900 individuals that we have now typed on the AFI 6.0 chip and looked for autosomal sites that tell us something about who we are with this idea of community. And they're very dependent upon the parameters that you are attempting to test. In this case, if we ask for four populations, we can get four populations out of this data set, and we get varying levels of admixture associated with them. And if we pull out just this one over here on the very far right, that looks pretty homogeneous. When we look at it, these are samples that come out of Bolivia, we'll find that really only about half of them are fairly uniform as far as what we would classify as Native American. The others are admixed to various degrees from both different parts of Europe and Africa, as we see that data. So, who is this guy? We collected this DNA in Bolivia. All four grandparents of that individual live in Bolivia today, but genetically they have some connections to other places in the world. And you can take this to as deep as you want it to go. We took one community, a place called Filomena Mata in Veracruz in Mexico, who on the gross level is absolutely uniform and different and identifiable from any other of these, any other group in Mexico that we looked at. And when we look at them individually and on a higher level, we'll see that there are differences within that community, so much so that we can even get down to individuals that belong to the same nuclear family, parents and children, okay, and split them away from second cousin level relatives. So it's really dependent on who you are, or the question who you are is very dependent on how close you want to look. And just one other statement on this that we will be presenting next month at ASHG, and that is that when you start looking at the HapMap data and you look at FST values between populations in the HapMap data, there's some very significant values. As you start to fill that in, which we've done with about another 20 populations that were not included in the HapMap data, but were included in some of this that I just showed you, the FST values between populations are dropping, and they're dropping significantly in the idea that we're moving more towards a continuum rather than discrete populations, I think. And that's really what I... So that we really are going towards that first idea that the Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation was established on, is trying to demonstrate to the people of the world that we are, in fact, one big family. And just to end, I know this is a poor slide I took with my cell phone last night, but it just struck me on the front of the Justice Building just down the street here. Justice is the great interest of man on earth. Wherever her temple stands, there is a foundation for social security, general happiness, and the improvement and progress of our what? Our race. What is the meaning of the word race? Yeah, people. Homo sapiens sapien, I think. Right. And I think ultimately that's where this is going to go. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions.
These are another important thing with these data sets. And the data set that we have is open to the academic community for research. These are some of the papers that we've published in the last year using the data in this data set. Most of these are involved with both Y haplogroups and mitochondrial haplogroups.
Thank you. We're going to take a couple of minutes for questions. The 100 years of solitude, the 100-year rule, does that apply if a individual has died, or do you limit the 100 years?
We keep it at 100 years, whether the person is alive or has died. In the United States, the law sits right around 75 years as far as publicly available data, like census data. In the United Kingdom, it sits at 100 years, and most other European nations, I think, are at 100 years, and that's why we've decided to go in this age of the Internet.
Yes, it was a wonderful presentation, and thank you, Scott. Okay, we'll see everyone back at 3:20 for our last session today.